And if you want to learn about this transport coefficient at strong coupling, then you run out of options, basically, because the only tool that you could have available is the lattice. And the lattice is an intrinsically Euclidean scheme. So if you try to compute real-time quantities, then you run into lots of numerical difficulties. So people got interested in this because at the Rick experiment at Brookhaven, so they claimed to have found the quark gluon plasma, as you all know. And it turns out that in one of the early stages of the evolution, you need to do some sort of hydrodynamic flow. Okay? And it turns out that including the shear viscosity in this flow is very important if you want to fit the data. And perhaps a bit counterintuitively to what people were expecting, they found that this shear viscosity was actually very low when measured in units of the entropy. So they measured that the shear viscosity over the entropy density is about, okay, well, there's a big uncertainty in this number. So more or less a factor of 2. But what I want to point out is that this looks like 1/4 pi. Okay? And this is the most perfect fluid that has been found in nature. So it's the fluid with the lowest shear viscosity you ever measured. And this is telling us that the quark-gluon plasma is strongly coupled. Why? Because, well, basically, the shear viscosity is telling you if you have a fluid with, and there's two blades moving at different momenta, then if there's a high shear viscosity, then these blades will come to the same speed pretty quick. But for that to happen, a particle has to be able to travel from this point to this point fairly quick, right? So the interactions have to be low. So you learn that high viscosities are associated with small interactions, and low viscosity, perhaps counterintuitively, corresponds to higher interactions, to strong coupling. OK, so.
Corresponds to strong coupling.
But what I mean by strong interaction is strong coupling. So people started getting interested in computing these things. And of course, the natural tool nowadays to use to compute things at strong coupling is to use ADS-CFT. Okay? And amazingly, if you start off with the simplest model, so you work with ADS-CFT, you just say that you have your gauge theory is dual to Einstein gravity and to the Sitter space, then you get exactly that E/S is 1/4 pi, quite generally. Okay, so that's a bit of motivation. And here what I'm going to talk about is how to compute transport coefficients such as the shear viscosity and the conductivity in theories where you have higher derivatives. So you no longer have just Einstein gravity, but you have some higher order corrections. And these are important because they're basically telling you how to compute things away from the infinite coupling limits. Okay, higher derivative corrections will correspond to large but not infinite coupling in the dual field theory. Hence the interest. Okay.
Mention dependence for this value
here?
Yeah, does it depend on which number of dimension?
No, I mean,
the system. Yeah.
No.
No. It does. I mean, the spatial dimension has to be greater than 2. Otherwise, you can't define shear as well.
But beyond that,
the higher is also similar.
What?
If you go higher in number of dimensions,
that's what you
do. Doesn't matter. So four flat dimensions, 5, 6, 7. How many you wish? E/S is always equal to this. Both eta and s depend on the number of dimensions, but their ratio doesn't in Einstein gravity. Okay. Right. So okay. So brief outline. I'm going to do a lightning review of hydrodynamics and ADS-CFT methods. Then I'm going to show you how to compute E/S in Einstein gravity as an example. Then generalizations. Prior derivatives. something which I'll call the pole method. And this will lead us to formulae, let me say, a la Walt, or eta and sigma. Okay, I'll explain this what it is in a minute. Yes?
It also has perturbatively, but in the planar limit.
If you could be perturbatively, but in fact, you want to know the answer. So I think it's something like,
at least for Young-Mills theories, 1 over g fourth, and then there's a log here. I can't remember the power here, but it basically blows up. Excuse me?
G minus.
Might as well. There's an overall minus.
But basically, the Schiff viscosity blows up at zero. It becomes infinite. Because of what I said, at zero coupling, particles can move freely, so Schiff viscosity is very high. Okay. So, hydrodynamics.
G angle square.
No, but you, so that's a QCD calculation or something like that. Amit wants to know where do the end go? Where does the n go if he's doing a large n?
So I think you just replace the g by lambda. I think that's it. What I can tell you for sure is that at weak coupling, then it definitely gets an infinite shear viscosity. Okay, so hydrodynamics is basically
an effective field theory which is valid at large wavelengths and small frequencies. Okay? So you're looking at perturbations around thermodynamic equilibrium, where locally you're still at thermodynamic equilibrium, but on large scales you see some fluctuations. Okay? And in this regime, you can do a derivative expansion where the derivatives are much smaller compared to some typical length scale of the system. Okay, for conformal field theories, this length scale is basically 1 over T, the temperature. So you want all your derivatives to be small compared to that. So let me just give you the typical example. So in the hydrodynamic limit, since you're interested in these modes which have long wavelengths, small frequency, typically you're interested in conserved currents. So one nice conserved current to consider is just the energy momentum tensor. And this has the hydrodynamic expansion, so the energy density. This is the fluid four velocity. And there's a pressure term. So basically, this is the thermodynamic part. And then there are viscous corrections, which tell you how to go beyond the equilibrium setting. Okay? So here there are no derivatives of u, of the four velocity, and here you have an expansion in derivative u. Okay? And the first term here is just, this guy is something like, where this symmetrizes and takes the trace out. Okay? In this case, this is the shear viscosity. Okay, so this is the hydrodynamic expansion. Now, how do you compute this using field theory methods? Well, let's just use linearized theory. Let's compute Txy. The Txy that you obtain if you perturb the background metric by a small Hxy perturbation. Okay, so you just take that expression. I haven't told you what all these things are. Let me just, not in the new. But at the end of the day, what you get is that Txy okay, and then linearized theory, and to lowest order the derivative of expansion. I'm just taking the first viscous term, okay? So if I go into Fourier space, now, according to linearized theory, this is just telling me this is the retarded Green's function. Sorry. So this is essentially the Green's function, P minus I omega. What I want to point out here is that if you take the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function, you divide it by I omega, and you take omega to zero, so you get rid of all these, the other terms in the derivative expansion, then this gives you exactly eta. Okay? So what we're looking for is computing the retarded Green's function for two HXY perturbations, the retarded Green's function for two energy momentum tensors. The way we'll do it in ADS-CFT is by using these perturbations. But the point is that the imaginary part captures these transport coefficients in the low frequency expansion, okay? Okay, so now ADS-CFT. Once again, I'll be very brief. So this is just the idea that the gauge theory can be equivalent to a gravity or string theory. The best known example is simply N equals 4 super Young Mills. So it's conjectured that there's a perfect equivalence between this theory and that theory at any value of the coupling, of decoupling than n. And the map is, so let's define the Etouffe coupling. Okay. And basically, then the map is lambda maps onto 1 over alpha prime squared, this is on ADS-5.65. So this is the radius of ADS, which is equal to the radius of S5. And lambda over n maps onto G string. Okay, so when you're doing an expansion, you're doing an expansion here, you see that if you go to infinite lambda, then you're saying that the radius of your space is much larger than the string scale. So basically, strings go away. All you get is the massless supergravity modes. But if you want to include corrections around the infinite coupling limits, then you need to consider corrections to the supergravity action. Okay? So since alpha prime has a length scale involved, you can see that alpha prime corrections correspond to higher derivative corrections. So you no longer get just Einstein gravity, you get some terms with higher numbers of curvatures in it. Okay, so if you want to learn about the finite but large coupling limit, you need to include these higher derivative corrections.
derivative expansion or one theory maps into the derivative expansion or the other?
Okay. So you mean this derivative expansion? Okay. No, okay, sorry. This is a completely different derivative expansion. Sorry for the confusion.
Any expansion? No, but in gauge theory and gravity. Yes. Is the derivative expansion related?
No. So this derivative expansion I'm talking about on the gravity side is simply you get r, so the outside Hilbert action, and then you get some corrections, say r to the fourth, plus etc. this is telling you basically how the field theory quantities behave around lambda equals infinity. So you get the leading result, and then you get corrections in 1 over root lambda, when you quantity that you're computing. So an expansion in derivatives here is actually an expansion around infinite coupling on the field theory side. Okay, and so the prescription for computing Green's functions in ADS-CFT is essentially given by this. It's telling you that the partition function of n equals 4 with some sources is equal to lowest order to beyond shell gravity action with some prescribed values, some prescribed boundary values for the fields
on ADS5. Okay, so let me draw a picture. So this is ADS5, process 5, and the source here. So here outside you have n equals 4. Here you have this superstring. And putting some sources in the partition function corresponds to turning on a field in the bulk. Putting some field in the bulk, and then with some prescribed boundary value. So there'll be a non-trivial profile inside EDS bulk. So if I want to compute the Green's function, the only thing that I have to do is compute the on-shell gravity action with these prescribed boundary values. And then, for instance, if I want this retarded Green's function, I just need to differentiate the action twice with respect to this phi naught. Okay? So, any razors? Okay, so now let's try using ADS-CFT to compute the shear viscosity. Okay, let's start with some examples. So what's the prescription? I want to compute this correlation. Right, the correlator of two TXYs. So what I need to do is take my ADS bulk, described by some metric, turn on this HXY perturbation, get the effective action to second order, and then differentiate. So just like I described there. Okay? So the action, the effective five-dimensional action is something like this. So this is the gravitational action. Yes, 5 bit of the action doesn't concern us. And now you take your metric, you perturb by an HXY, and you get an effective action for the perturbation. So you need to expand this to quadratic order in your perturbation. So let me perhaps be more clear. So I perturb the metric by a perturbation of this form. I plug it into this section, and now let's find what the action is to quadratic order. Okay, and what you get is So this is the effective action that you get.
Yes.
Have you done a gauge choice, and you have one degree of freedom
on it? Yes. So I'm choosing the radial gauge, so all perturbations of the form h, r, u are set to zero. And this perturbation decouples from all the others basically because of SCO3 invariant. So I need to assume.
X, Y, are, when you say X, Y, what's an equation? Sorry,
I'm missing. Yeah, okay. So my metric looks like. So the same metric component serves for all this dx, so I have, let me say dx, dy, dz for the time being. Okay?
Why your field phi depends on t as if you also have form?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
So can you explain why you're considering a two-point function for surf tensor, not the one-point function over there? So there you were discussing one-point.
Yeah, but the one-point function still depends on h again. So I need to differentiate once more to get the Green's function. So there's two ways of thinking.
Okay.
Now, so you have
this. I need to tell you the prescription for computing the Green's function. So I told you that it's the on-shell action, but here we have a problem. Because we're working at finite temperature, and at finite temperature, this metric describes a black hole sitting in ADS. And the black hole has a horizon. So if I just compute the on-shell action, I will get a boundary term, but the boundary term has two pieces, one at the boundary of ADS5 and another one at the horizon of the black hole. So which one do I take? Do I take them both? Do I just take one? And the prescription is, and this can be justified more carefully, is that you should only take the ADS boundary piece, okay? And you need to impose some boundary condition at the horizon, which I'll explain in a minute, okay? So let's first see what's the equation of motion that comes from this. So the equation of motion is simply dr right? It's just this. And now notice that this is a canonical momentum. The canonical momentum associated with r. So absolute constant here. If I differentiate the action with respect to the r phi, this is what I get. So this is the canonical momentum associated with r translations. Okay? So not what you need to do, what you would need to do is to solve this equation, plug it in there, and compute the boundary value. Okay? But I want you to notice something. We're only interested in the low frequency approximation, right? At the end of the day, we're going to take omega goes to zero. So we can work to linear order in omega. But if we work to a linear order in omega, then this piece goes away. It's order omega squared. So we learn that PR of pi is zero, essentially, up to order omega squared. So this quantity in the low frequency approximation is like a conserved current. It doesn't flow in the bulk as you change the r coordinate. So you can compute it at the boundary, you can compute it at the horizon, you can compute it wherever you want, you always get the same answer. Okay? So my retarded Green's function its limit when the frequency goes to zero of the on-shell action. R goes to infinity, 5/5. Okay. You can see this simply by taking that action and evaluating it on shell. Okay. So when you evaluate it on shell, what happens? This omega square piece goes away because it's order omega square. Here I integrate once, I get the equation of motion, but I also get a boundary term, and the boundary term is simply so that this is the on-shell action. Now, when I differentiate twice with respect to the boundary value, I kill off this guy, and then I divide by the boundary value here. Okay? Right, so this is the Green's function, or at least its imaginary part. Now, there could be contributions from that boundary terms to the real part, but not to the imaginary part.
Which comes from the boundary radius. And there is no contribution from the
right. I think that the prescription for getting the Ricardo Green's function is that.
Right. Can you just find this result by considering Kruskal extension of the black hole?
Yes, I think so. You can use some Schwinger-Kelvish propagators, and then you can justify this form a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know the details.
Well, even in that case, you're going to have a singularity at center, which effectively.
Are you doing this in Euclidean?
Here? No, in Lorentz's signature.
So, okay, if there is a singularity, what should you do?
Nobody knows.
I don't know, yeah. So you just say, so how do you justify the fact that there's a boundary that contributes?
How do
just
you
a, it's just a,
well, yeah. There is that more formal justification, which I don't know the details. But I can give you a more or less intuitive argument why it should work. Okay, but maybe I could say that at the end. Okay.
Why did you have to neglect this omega square here? Just cancel and when you neglect.
You're right. Here it cancels. But in general, it doesn't have to cancel. It could show up in boundary terms. Here you're absolutely correct. Here it cancels. Mm-hmm.
But here I wouldn't neglect it. Yes, you have something to compare it to.
Excuse me.
The equation of motion. It's not important.
No, because it's important. This is important. I'm going to show you why this is important in 2 seconds. What I want to tell you is that this part, I told you that I have to compute it at the bottom of ABS, but now I have this flow equation, which tells me that actually pi is the flow. So instead of evaluating it at the boundary of ABS, I can evaluate it at the horizon. And it turns out it's much more convenient to do things at the horizon than at the boundary. Okay? So that's why. This is going to be important.
Most of you are saying that when you neglect something, you should neglect it with respect to something which is bigger. I haven't seen that.
And which is bigger?
Well, okay, I'm taking omega goes to zero, keeping pi fixed.
I think his objection is omega is a dimensionful quantity, so you're strictly speaking okay. Taking omega by
Is that it?
Go on, then.
Okay. Well, there's this GDT here, right? So you can, this term is actually, so. It's omega squared over 4 pi. So omega is small compared to the temperature. You're right. Omega over T is much smaller than 1.
So you're saying in the end, this horizon scale does contribute. Either the horizon or the boundary is
No. No, it's not that. So you really want the ADS boundary contribution. But it turns out that in this special case, because there's no mass term for phi, there's only this omega squared term, which I can throw away. In that special case, then I can evaluate phi wherever I want. I don't have to evaluate it at the boundary of ADS. I can evaluate it at the horizon. But in general, this phi will flow. And the prescription for getting the Green's function is its value at the boundary of ADS, not at the horizon. It's just that in this case it coincides. You see?
Right, so numerically it doesn't manage on the horizon. if you do compute.
It's
equal to whatever you compute on one.
Yes, yes.
Linear order, no.
Yeah. Right, okay.
The only thing that's commuting, and that probably just what the questions are about, is because if you're taking frequency to zero, R to infinity, and temperature may or may not be going to zero, but you're taking frequency smaller than temperature.
Yes.
And normally, physically, that limit of small temperature versus small frequency is a. But that one doesn't commute.
I'm not taking small temperature.
Yeah. So, but these other limits, are they commuting if you take frequency?
Yes, yes.
That's not always the case, right? I know there's not any things like that.
So if you have extremal black holes, there when you're taking the t goes to zero limit,
yeah.
And you're also taking the frequency to zero, then you have to worry about that.
Right.
There will be an order of limits there. But here,
I'm thinking of the holographic superconductor. I know that the R goes to various limits and the frequency goes to zero limit is also a tricky one. That depends on how you do that. But that's what you're saying with the flying.
Here, this isn't the flying. Right. It will apply for extremal wireless.
Sorry, but you said L 1 over T, so you want T to be much less than 1. You wanted alpha L to be large. You said you want every variation to be much smaller than L.
Yes.
T is much smaller than 1.
So
you are in a sense taking what he said, small temperature, no?
No, no. I'm taking small frequencies compared to T.
But that formula doesn't make no sense now. That formula, L 1 over T?
Well, I think it's the same thing.
Okay, maybe I just
It's the variation.
You were saying that thing should be large. That I was.
No. It's the variations compared to that length scale.
So the right thing is omega over t much smaller than 1. Okay.
Yeah, but it's equivalent, right?
Okay.
No, so omega also defines the time scale. So. Okay, so right, pi doesn't flow. Let me get to the next step. So now shear viscosity of that entire heat function or atom, right? This amounts to now, I've already told you that in the low frequency approximation, pi doesn't flow. So I don't have to take r at infinity. I can take it at the horizon.
And neither does I omega phi. So omega dr phi is order omega squared. And the easy way to see this is that here in this special case, I'm talking about an hxy perturbation, right? So imagine that I switch off the frequency. I don't make it time dependent. Then I know that a constant phi has to be a solution because it's just a coordinate transformation in the x and y directions.
Maybe I sharpen a little bit. If when you say it doesn't flow, you mean that pi is independent of r, right? That's
yes.
But if supposing you left omega in, would you have found that the omega dependence was proportional to omega times r, or would it be the omega over k controlling it? So the reason I ask is that if it's omega r that's controlling the omega dependence, and then for some r, there will always be an important contribution for omega?
Yeah, but what's controlling the expansion here is omega over t. But
so if you actually really integrated the thing and omega took that limit, it really is omega not compared to r?
No, it's omega compared to t. Yeah. I always have this combination to work with. I can tune it to be as small as I want.
Well, I agree that that's a parameter in your problem, but it's not the only parameter in your problem. So the question is, which is important?
It's just saying there's a mass term medias. Mm-hmm. And if this frequency is much lower, then...
Yeah. Mass term is small, so the field doesn't fall.
That's correct.
So then, I'm just about the formula just wrote. There is omega in the denominator, but there is no other omega anywhere, right? Phi of r over phi of r.
It's here. It's here. It's inside pi.
So pi depends on omega?
Yes.
I thought pi is a function of r.
Yes, but it's also a function of omega.
Oh, okay. Phi doesn't depend on omega, but phi does.
Okay, wait a minute. Omega dr phi is order omega squared. Omega phi is order omega. Well, let me solve the equations and then it will all become clear.
Okay. guess my intuition is telling me is that if I had been doing this in flat space, I would have thought that fields as a function of mass would have kind of you call a follow-up, it'd be e to minus mr.
Yes.
So if I follow the m dependence, r would be important, right? And then that converts to a parallel when m goes to zero in a way which is pretty subtle. And so the statement that there's no r dependence in that limit is just a statement.
Right. So the fact that the reason I flow, this equation is only valid in a straight pipe, isn't it?
Yes.
You put omega equals to zero. So what Cliff was asking, if you were to keep omega blank, so the answer to your question is that if you were to keep omega and look for, you know, eventually he's only interested in a cupola formulas when he put frequency to zero.
Well,
but if you would look at the dispersion relations, then that flow is actually important.
Yes.
So there is no conservation, the pi is no longer, you know, satisfied in simple equations.
That means that the limit, the order of limits is important. And the cupola relation, that's a notoriously subtle thing, right?
No,
but you're saying the right one
is the
right,
right answer. So he's saying for that, and said, you know, as long as you are interested only in a strict chiral, so you're not looking at the higher order terms and frequency, then that's a correct statement. But it's also known that that's only a correct statement in a strict chiral. So to go beyond that, you have to take into account.
So phi equals constant is a solution.
No, I agree that that's a solution, but it's the order of the limits that counts, and you need to get burned if you do that order of limits. But you're saying it's
a ball, right?
It's also a conformal scale, so there's only one scale which is temperature and frequency, right? And there
you don't have a finite density here.
No, not in
this. No. Not here. But maybe you could say this earlier if you like. Okay.
So this is order omega squared. So you see that I'm also free to take I omega phi at any radius that I want. And in particular, I can choose the horizon, OK? So eta is essentially the low frequency limit of this canonical momentum evaluated at the horizon. Let me call it r naught I omega phi. And now notice I omega phi is a constant, basically. So it's the same either at the ADS boundary or at the horizon. So I can just call it phi naught. OK, so this is the formula. Now, how do I determine quantities at the horizon? This is the nice part. They're essentially fixed by regularity at the horizon. OK? How do we see this? Well, if you have a massless scalar close to a horizon, what can it depend on? Since it has to be regular at the horizon, it can only depend on the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, right? Either ingoing or outgoing. And that amounts to saying that And in Fourier space, this is just plus or minus I omega over 4 pi t is phi over r minus r naught. Okay? So you see, at the horizon, the behavior of phi is completely fixed. There's a relation between the derivative with respect to the radius and the derivative with respect to time. But this one, we know what it is. It's just I omega. Okay? So we can just plug this into the definition of the canonical momentum, and this will automatically give us our answer. Okay? So in this case, canonical momentum is simply right. If I use that relation, right? So I just plug in this relation here, and I need to use that basically root of minus g can be written as 4 pi t. And then it all cancels, and I just get this. So I finally get that the shear viscosity is this gxx 3 half, which turns out to be r naught 3 cubed. And I'm missing some factors of L. L here, the ABS radius, but let's just set that to 1. This immediately tells you that it over S is equal to 1 over 4 pi. Why? Because S is equal to the area. The area is just this gxx, the 3 halves, over 4 gn. So if you do eta over S, you get 1 over 4 pi. Okay. What, now let me try to quickly talk about what I actually did. So what happens in higher derivative theories? In higher derivative theories, your action is not, it's not this. There's more stuff, a bunch more stuff, well, with higher derivatives in it, of course. So what happens to all this story? It turns out that the story goes exactly through. I still define a canonical momentum like I did somewhere. That is to say, pi is equal to delta S, delta dr phi. This is some generalized canonical momentum. So let's see. Imagine that I had a term which is like this. Then this would just give me a contribution of this form to the canonical momentum, and so on and so forth. This defines a generalized canonical momentum. I omega phi doesn't flow because of the same reason. Phi equals constant still is a solution. Therefore, its variation is proportional to omega. Phi as well doesn't flow. Because it's exactly the same equation. But by definition, by construction of what phi is, the equation of motion for phi is once again dr pi is equal to order omega squared. Notice that this pi is complicated now. Okay, it's not just given by this. There's some extra contribution by ddr phi, and so on and so forth. Lots more contributions. But this is still true. I omega doesn't flow, so the shear viscosity can still be computed by evaluating these things at the horizon, and at the horizon, regularity imposes this. Okay, the horizon behavior is completely fixed. It doesn't depend on the theory you're considering. This is just regularity of a scalar field close to a horizon. It doesn't depend on the theory. That's the essential thing here. So there are two ingredients, basically. One, there is no flow. I have to assume that. Not all transport coefficients are associated to these pi's which don't flow. There are others which do flow, like relaxation time. There, it corresponds to going one order above in the hydrodynamic expansion. So this omega squared term becomes important, and you have to do the flow. But for these type of coefficients, which can be obtained by a Kubo formula, so here I mentioned the shear viscosity, but this applies equally for the conductivity or scalar charges. In those cases, this whole procedure is valid. Okay? There is still a canonical momentum. There is still a trivial flow. You can still compute things at the horizon. And the horizon behavior is determined by this. Okay? So this is called the generalized canonical momentum method. You can use it in higher derivative theories. But I want to show you that there's actually a quicker method. So I don't want to work with this nasty pi, which will have lots of derivatives on pi. I would have to write, I would have to write the effective action. It will have some undetermined functions here, here, and in all the other terms. I would have to integrate by parts, reshuffle things so that I can find this what this pi is, use the near horizon behavior, and so on and so forth. Now I want to use a trick. And the trick is simply that, as I told you, this horizon behavior is universal in a sense. It doesn't depend on the details. It doesn't depend on the metric that you have. It doesn't depend on the theory that you have. All you know is that at the horizon, this is the equation that phi satisfies. So I can immediately write down that close to the horizon, the effective action for my perturbation is always of the form. Now let me move on to the dimensions. So it has to be exactly of the same form as that one, as the two derivative action. Because this action at the horizon leads to this constraint. However, the coefficient doesn't have to be 1 over 16 pi g. It will be something else. So this is at the horizon. Okay. Yes. In
uncharged backgrounds.
Again, that might be an important thing, but so if I look at the, in that case, you're looking at the ratio of electric to magnetic field or something like that. In principle, you'd be wanting that infinity, and your statement would be that if you evaluate that horizon, that's just okay.
It's exactly the same thing. Okay. So you start with the Maxwell action, you turn on an AX perturbation. This decouples from everything else in the low frequency limits. Now call it phi, you get this action.
So in that case, I know the answer. If you had been, actually at the horizon, it would have been some universal thing like pi or something. You get some ball of connectivity or some. But there's something which is frequency independent.
The DC
connectivity,
you're
talking.
But you're right. It depends in theory what
the
Gell mentioned. Which is that
it's
really the case that there's no flow in the uncharged case. Mm. So the equilibrium charge density must be zero. You have equilibrium charge density. It's a risk flow.
Yeah. You get a mass term basically for this scale. So it evolves in the ABS space.
So the statement would be that if I think, so that example I kind of understand better. So in that, you're saying that in the limit that I take the charge sensitive to zero, I should be seeing like I'm universally getting the rising value controlling the connectivity. Let me think about that.
Yeah.
Again, that's roughly related to the fact that in that case, you can take the Dewan scale, you have performance. Mm-hmm. The Dewan scale is temperature plus two dimensional program.
The story goes exactly through. The only thing that changes is that this coupling is not this, it's something else. So it's of this form.
Okay, so going back to what I was saying, so in all these examples where my perturbation is controlled by some massless scalar, I know that at the horizon, the behavior of the scalar must be this, and this is given by a two derivative action of this form, okay, where this is. This should all be taken close to the horizon. Okay? It's just that this coefficient depends on your higher derivative corrections. Okay? You have a bunch of higher derivative terms. At the horizon, you can collapse them, if you want, into an effective two-derivative action. But this coefficient, and this coefficient is really what's controlling the shear viscosity, right? The shear viscosity has this coupling here. So this coefficient changes in general. And what I really want is to figure out what's this coefficient here. Because if I know that, I automatically get the transport coefficient. Right? So in this case, this is just, let me call this V because it's the volume of the horizon. Okay. Right? I have higher derivatives, K will change, but the shear viscosity is exactly of the same form. Okay, so now that I know this, then I can use a trick. How do you choose them? Well, at which level? At the level of the perturbation?
No.
No.
So then your answer is incomplete. You choose one.
You know, in some sectors, you know. So there's two answers to that. So one of them is the phenomenological approach, which is maybe we can look at everything that's there and see how it behaves. You can check how the coefficients of these higher derivative corrections compare to the parameters of the CFT, and you can still get interesting answers. Answer number two is you can use string theory. String theory tells you at least the first corrections in type 2B you know in this sector.
That's what I'm saying. There are gazillions of corrections, not only involved in arc, also involved in the fluxes.
Yes. You know that they don't matter for this calculation. In some cases, you know exactly, you have complete control, and you know which corrections matter, and you know which they are. In type 2B, this is the case. And if you ask.
I mean, in the backgrounds that he's considering, only the five-form flux is important.
Yes.
And then the terms involving the five-form flux and the graviton are known.
So the graviton only mixes this five-form thing?
No, so the.
For a C4, I mean.
So suppose you've got some arbitrary flux which is zero to linear order. In the high derivative level, if the flux usually occurs as flux square, right? So if it occurs as flux square, you don't care about it.
At the level of the first perturbative correction, you have complete control. Okay. But in general, you're right. We're doing some sort of phenomenological approach, and we try different kind of corrections to see what they get.
So can you just say which corrections you included this?
Well, okay, here we're talking about any corrections. This method works for any correction you'd like to consider. One day when you figure out what are the right ones, you just plug them into this formula and it works. Okay, so now let me just give you the trick. So I want to figure out what this coefficient is. Well, what happens if I plug into this action, the solution that comes from this? Well, let me do perhaps things more properly. So if you solve that near horizon condition, what you get is that phi goes like r minus r naught to the I omega over 4 pi t. That's the solution. Okay? If I plug this into this action, I get zero. I get zero because I know that the action on shell reduces to a boundary term. But the particular boundary term that I get in this case is the r of phi phi. And this is a constant in the low frequency limit. So let me try something else. Let me try plugging a perturbation, which is not exactly on shell, but it's very close. So instead of plugging with omega, I plug it with some alpha. Okay? If you plug this perturbation here, and you expand near the horizon, then what you get is that action So you see that when alpha is equal to omega, that is when phi satisfies the equation of motion, you get zero. But if you don't plug in omega, you plug in alpha, then you get a pole. You get a pole in the action, a simple pole. Okay? And this is the only simple pole that can show up. It's precisely the one that comes from this term. So I told you that the effective action at the horizon is given by this. That's true, but there could be also boundary terms. Some boundary terms which don't affect the equation of motion. But those boundary terms can never get you simple poles when you plug in the solution. Okay? I don't have to, maybe I can explain it yet. But the point is that the simple pole contribution only comes from this bit of the action. But this is great because it's telling you that this coefficient is up to a factor which you know. It's the residue of this simple pole. Okay? So at the end, if you want to compute transport coefficients, there's a recipe, which is simply pick your Lagrangian. For instance, for the case of the shear viscosity, you have a Lagrangian which depends on the Ricci scalar, curvatures, and so on and so forth. You take your Lagrangian, you perturb the metric by a perturbation of that form, hxy. Okay. You plug into your Lagrangian this solution. You read off the residue. And then I have to check my notes, but I think it's this. Okay. So so you don't have to worry about anything. Right? The only thing that you need to do is write down a Lagrangian. So let me give you just an example.
Actually,
has to be yes, on shell. But if you make it slightly off shell, it develops a pulse. And the simple pulse captures the transport coefficient you're looking at. So let me give you an example.
First corrections from string theory. C to the fourth. And this C to the fourth is some complicated contraction of Weyl tensors. That's what I can see. So you get the picture. It's some complicated contraction of four Weyl tensors. I start off with this Lagrangian. I don't need to worry about possible boundary terms. I don't need that. I just take my computer, I plug in this action, and if I evaluate it on the metric where I add some perturbation. So I can do it in this fashion. Pick one direction in the flat direction of ADS 5 and transform it into dx plus 5 r dy, where this guy is R minus R naught. Okay? So I simply evaluate these invariants on a special metric, which is my background metric perturbed by this guy. Okay? I just evaluate this. And then I expand near the horizon. And at the horizon, this will have a simple pole. Okay? And of course, I can't prove it here. You would have to take a computer or something to see it. But what happens is that you get precisely one plus. So the Lagrangian you get this. There's higher order poles, sure. There's regular terms. But the point is that at the horizon, the residue of the pole gives you the shear viscosity. So you have to believe me that this is actually the correct result for the shear viscosity when you include these C to the fourth corrections. The whole point is that I don't need to worry about solving differential equations. I don't need to worry about boundary terms. I just write down my favorite Lagrangian. This Lagrangian could have anything I want. It could have derivatives of curvatures and so on, as many as I want. I evaluate all those invariants on a special perturbed metric, and I read off the residue. And this automatically gives me the shear viscosity. And here I'm telling you about shear viscosity, but the same reasoning applies for conductivities, for DC conductivities and uncharged backgrounds. There my Lagrangian will be f squared. And then I could have nabla f squared, nabla f squared, f to the fourth, I mean, whatever. Whichever contractions that you want. And all I have to do is evaluate these guys on a perturbed gauge field, exactly in the same fashion. I just, my ax, I call it phi. I plug in this ansatz. I read off the residue at the pole, and I get the DC conductivity. Okay, so,
slightly off selection, you need to know the solution.
So the solution to the background metric. Yes, you need to know the background metric.
That's
not the correct one. It's a linearized
solution. And the solution of what? So you solve for the background perturbatively in these higher derivative terms. That's the first step. Once you have this background, then you can apply this to find out shear viscosity, conductivities, and so on and so forth. Let me just mention something, though, that if you're just interested in the first order correction, then actually you don't need to correct the background, at least to find what eta over S is. And this is simply because eta over S is given by 1 over 4 pi universally in the Einstein case. So no matter which metric you plug into it, whether it's corrected or not, it will always give eta over S equal to 1 over 4 pi. Okay? And of course, since you're working to linear order, so what I'm telling you is that you plug in your perturbed metric here, but the perturbations don't matter. And if you plug it here, then the perturbations will come up at order gamma squared. So actually, you don't need to correct the background if you're working to first order. Please to find eta over S. If you want to know how eta behaves as a function of temperature, then you need to do that. Okay. So let me just write down a formula. I don't have much time to deduce it. So how do you get now, using this, how do you get some sort of almost covariant formula for the shear viscosity or for the conductivity? Okay, so you have some Lagrangian, which is R plus the cosmological constant plus some function of Riemann's. And reach, so whatever. But no derivatives on curvatures. And now you want to evaluate these invariants on a perturbed metric of this form, where I do such a perturbation. Excuse me?
Why do you say that you shouldn't consider derivative on
curvatures? Well, because it would be a different form, it would be more common. Okay, I'm giving you a formula where...
Are you sure in the same order there are now terms in...
Oh, no. Yeah, sure. You're right. They cut you off. No, at this one that I showed you, the secret of force, this is correct. Now I just want to show you, as an example of the usage of this method, how you can get analytic formula for these transport coefficients.
No, all I'm asking, in supersymmetrization of this term, C to the force,
yes.
Are there terms which have derivatives of Riemann terms?
No. These are all the terms which only have metrics in them.
Sorry, this doesn't involve any other
calculus? No.
I mean, it'll involve the phi form flux, it'll show up as C cubed F squared, but you don't care about them because we wrote a paper showing that those terms actually don't alter the result for eta over S.
So in this one, this is only a Bosonic term.
This is the only relevant term.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, maybe I should do a simple example instead of starting with the shear viscosity. Let me just write down conductivity in a general theory. Let me choose the Lagrangian as minus 4e squared. That's a root minus g here. And now I have okay. So this is my theory of the electric field, my Maxwell theory, but I modified it. So instead of having metrics contracting these Fs, I have this tensor, which could be whatever I want. What is the conductivity in this case? You simply apply this procedure that I told you. So plug in, so define your gauge field AA only has one component, which is AX, which I choose to be that. I plug it into here, and I look for the single pole, okay? Keeping this arbitrary. And then you can show that what you'll get is, let's see. By looking for the simple pole, the conductivity is simply the volume over E squared. This is defined by this, but it's something by. Okay, so you have an analytic formula for the conductivity. Yes. All right. In fact, there's another formula, because
all you have to do is look for the pole, but there are two ways of obtaining a pole. So just by looking at this formula, I could set alpha to 0 or omega to 0. If I set omega to 0, then I get the pole that I've described. But there's another way of obtaining a pole, which is simply to set this to 0. So my perturbation is just phi. If I plug this into the Lagrangian, I will also get a pole. So there's another formula, which is the time formula, if you want. So this is actually equivalent to x, tx, tx. And of course, they should be the same, right? They have to give the same result. And they do. This is once again because of regularity at the horizon. Regularity of this Lagrangian at the horizon requires that this tensor has these two components which are equal at the horizon. Okay? So you can see that you could probably covariantize this formula pretty easily. So this is for the shear viscosity, for the conductivity, but you can also get one for the shear viscosity. And there it's slightly more complicated because now there are also terms with derivatives on that F, if you want. So let me just write down the final formula. So we can compare it with Walt's formula, okay? So for a metric of this type, so consider a general metric of this form, which has a horizon located at r equals r naught. Then the shear viscosity for such metrics are where these coefficients are. So the shear viscosity is given by a volume factor, just as before. And now it receives two types of contributions. One from single derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the curvature, and another one, which depends on this object alpha RT, which in turn is defined as a function of these y's, and y's are double derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the Riemann tensor. Okay? Now, let me just mention that the entropy density for such backgrounds is given by the Wald formula. The Wald formula essentially tells you that the entropy goes like x rt rt. Okay? So that's why I said that it's a Wald-like formula for shear viscosity. It also involves these derivatives, but crucially, for shear viscosity, you also need to take double derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the Riemann tensor. Okay. So previously in the literature, there was a proposal where basically they would say that the shear viscosity is just given by this term, so just by this one. But that doesn't work. It turns out that you need to include these double Riemann tensor derivatives contribution. Okay. Now, presumably, this can be covariantized, but whether that's useful or not, that's a question to be seen. And finally, let me just mention that both this formula for the shear viscosity, there's an analogous one for the conductivity, which I won't write down. Both this formula and both that whole method have been tested in pretty much every calculation that has been done in the literature. And, well, they work. Okay? So, yes, this was important as a proof of principle that you could write such formula for the shear viscosity and what's the relation to Wald's formula. But this method is really the quickest way that you have for obtaining these transport coefficients. All that you have to do is write down a Lagrangian, you plug it into a computer, you don't have to solve equations, you just look for simple pulp. And the residue gives you the transport coefficient. And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
So I think I understand what happens going on in the conductivity case, and the way I understand it, that if you had put in a density to start off with, as well as temperature and efficiency, the calculation you're doing is the density goes to zero first, then the frequency goes to zero, and then you're looking at the absolute depth for the conductivity.
For the conductivity.
Yeah, for example. And that, in that case, I know that your conclusion would be right. You could get this result, which is the controlled by the horizon black hole.
Yes.
But if you had instead calculated the conductivity in the CFT as a function of density and temperature,
yes,
by taking the frequency first to zero and then following the answer as a function of density and then taking the density to zero, you would have got a different answer. And so that limit, frequency to zero for the conductivity and density goes to zero, don't seem to each other. And the one that would be relevant for a condensed matter system, we'd want to follow this function of both density and temperature and then take the density to small.
No, but wait a minute, in those systems, you're keeping it always at finite temperature?
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Or are you taking the temperature to zero?
No, that's fine. Just follow temperature and density, and just fix those, take frequency to zero first. And then if you ask what happens in function density, you would not have got it controlled by the horizon.
But you're taking omega small compared to the chemical potential instead of the temperature.
Well, that's the issue that order of limits matters.
So I was claiming that if you always keep frequency smaller as compared to the temperature, forget about the chemical potential,
right. Then
the quantities are smooth in the chemical potential. You can turn it off to zero and nothing bad.
See, that's not true in the conductivity case. In the conductivity case, one limit gives you, and you can check it, because in the conductivity case, in one limit, it should just be a purely, there should be zero resistance, and there should be only Hall conductivity, which is... And in the other limit, you'll get something which is purely ohmic resistance and no Hall conductivity.
Maybe we should...
So anyway, my question is going to be that... So I think it's a physics question there, and in the... But I don't know what the corresponding statement is for the viscosities. And in particular, for the application to the heavy ion collisions, there must be, at some level, a non-zero density, right? So the approximation of the density is small must be something which people have to worry about for the applicability of the problem.
You're turning on some chemical potential in the background.
Yeah, just because I'm thinking that these things have an effect on number, right?
Well, E over S still gets you 1 over 4 pi in the lowest order approximation in that case, even when you have a non-trivial charge at bottom.
But in the order of limits you're talking about, where you...
No, but this is the shear viscosity. It's not the conductivity.
You're saying the issue is different in the shear viscosity. You don't have that...
In the shear viscosity, there's no... So, for the conductivity, imagine that you're computing the conductivity and you want to go to zero temperature at finite chemical potential. Then there's different ways of taking that limit and you get different answers. But the shear viscosity, no, it's continuous. You always get the same result. And it's basically because what I showed before is that the shear viscosity, the associated perturbation never flows. Okay? It's always massless. Because it's a tensor perturbation. There's not much that you can couple with. And we've seen that the behavior at the horizon is completely defined by this regularity condition. It's completely defined by this. So you see, this in general gives you a pole. But you don't care if it's a simple pole or a double pole. It doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, you're going to compute the canonical momentum with it, which is root minus g, drr, dr phi. And I can perform this computation without knowing what's going on. The cancellations also always occur. And the final result is going to be, it's always going to be this, no matter what happens at the horizon. So I can have a double pole there, a single pole. It's completely smooth.
maybe we can talk about this offline, but I know that in the Kamikaze case, it's not true to think they're controlled by
yes.
the so when that's true and when that's not true is worth putting down. And then, but you're saying that the same issues don't arise in the...
For the shiftless consciousness, this is always true. It's always controlled by the horizon. For the connectivity, if you have a charge background, then you have to worry about the flow.
Right.
All what I've said here doesn't apply there. What I've said here will determine... So there you have to solve a differential equation. You start off at the horizon and follow it all the way to the bound. And this gives you the boundary condition at the horizon. Or if you want, it gives you the connectivity of the horizon. So this is the membrane paradigm, right? You can say that there's a conductivity associated with stretched horizon. This membrane, this method will give you the conductivity of the stretched horizon. It's just that it doesn't coincide with the conductivity of the dual field. That's just fine. But for shear viscosity, I don't know any case where this doesn't happen. Because you would have to make this HXY massive.
Yeah,
I'll have
to talk about it later.
Okay, thanks for speaking again.